You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining me today for Jewish Potpourri, a program of readings of interest to the Jewish community. My name is Michael Wolin. We'll start today with some words by Rabbi Yonatan Sacks, former chief rabbi of Great Britain, now of blessed memory. The parsha we're reading today, the book of Devarim, the last book in the five books of Moses, is Parsha Re'eh. Rabbi Sacks titles this Making Poverty History, and he has some interesting things to say. He says, listen to these stories. Behind them lies an extraordinary insight into the nature of Jewish ethics. Story number one. Rabbi Abba used to bind money in his scarf, sling it on his back, and place it at the disposal of the poor. Story two. Mar Ukba had a poor man in his neighborhood into whose door socket he used to throw 4 coins every day. Once the poor man thought that I'll go see who's doing me this kindness. That day, Mar Ukba stayed late at the house of study, and his wife was coming home with him. As soon as the poor man saw them moving the door to leave the coins, he ran out after them. But they fled from him and hid. Why did they do this? Because it was taught one should throw himself into a fiery furnace rather than publicly put his neighbor to shame. That's in a Talmud, Ketubot 67b. Story number three. When Rabbi Jonah saw a member of a good family who had lost his money and was ashamed to accept charity, he would go and say to him, I've heard that an inheritance has come your way in a city across the sea. So here is an article of some value. Sell it and use the proceeds. When you are more affluent, you can repay me. As soon as the man took it, Rabbi Jonah would say, it's yours to keep as a gift. Once again, in Talmud, Vayikra Rabbah, chapter 34, verse 1. These stories are all deeply connected to the mitzvah of tzedakah, whose source is in this week's parsha. If anyone is poor among your fellow Israelites in any of the towns of the land of the Lord your God is giving you, do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted towards them. Rather, be open-handed and freely lend them whatever they need. That's in Deuteronomy chapter 15, verses 7 and 8. Give generously to them, and do so without a grudging heart. Then, because of this, the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and in everything you put your hand to. There will always be poor people in the land. Therefore, I command you to be open-handed toward your fellow Israelites, who are poor and needy in your land. Once again, Deuteronomy, this week's Parsha, chapter 15, verses 10 and 11. What we have here is a unique and still remarkable program for the elimination of poverty. The first extraordinary fact about the laws of tzedakah, as articulated in the oral tradition, is the concept itself. Tzedakah does not mean charity. We see this immediately in the form of a law inconceivable in any other moral system. Remember now, these are commandments, what we call mitzvahs. A mitzvah is a commandment. It's not just a good thing. It may be a good thing, but it is a commandment. Someone who does not wish to give tzedakah or to give less than is appropriate may be compelled to do so by a Jewish court of law. And this is from Maimonides in his Laws of Gifts to the Poor. Chapter 7, verse 10. Charity is always voluntary. Tzedakah is compulsory. Therefore, tzedakah does not mean charity. The nearest English equivalent is social justice. Now, I want you to hold that term, social justice. We're going to come back to that in the next article that I'm going to read to you, and it'll present a contrary view. The second is the principle evident in the three stories above. Poverty in Judaism is conceived not merely in material terms. The poor lack the means of sustenance. It is also conceived in psychological terms. Poverty humiliates. It robs people of dignity. It makes them dependent upon others, thus depriving them of independence, which the Torah sees as essential to self-respect. This deep psychological insight is eloquently expressed in the third paragraph of the Grace After Meals. Please, O Lord our God, do not make us dependent on the gifts or loans of other people, but only on your full, open, holy, and generous hand, so that we may suffer neither shame nor humiliation forever and all time. As a result, Jewish law focuses not only on how much we must give, but also on the manner in which we must do so. Ideally, the donor should not know to whom that person is giving. That's in story number one. Nor the recipient know from whom that person is receiving. Story number two. The third story exemplifies another principle. If a poor person does not want to accept tzedakah, we should practice a form of benign deception and give it to them under the guise of a loan. And once again, Maimonides, Laws of Gifts to the Poor, chapter 7, verse 9. Maimonides sums up the general principle this way. Whoever gives charity to the poor with bad grace and averted eyes has lost all the merit of his action, even though he gives him 1,000 gold pieces. He should give with good grace and with joy, and should sympathize with them in his plight. As it is said, "Have I not wept for those in trouble? Has not my soul grieved for the poor?" That's in Job, chapter 30, verse 25, and once again recited by Maimonides in Laws of Gifts to the Poor, chapter 10, verse 4. This is the logic behind two laws that are otherwise inexplicable. The first is, even a poor person who is dependent on tzedakah is obliged to give tzedakah. Once again, Laws of Gifts to the Poor, chapter 7, verse 5. This law seems absurd. Why should we give money to the poor so that they may give it to the poor? It makes sense only on this assumption, that giving is essential to human dignity, and tzedakah is the obligation to ensure that everyone has that dignity. The second is this famous ruling of Maimonides. The highest degree of charity, exceeded by none, is when a person assists a poor Jew by providing him with a gift or a loan, or by accepting him into a business partnership, or by helping him find employment. In a word, by putting him in a situation where he can dispense with other people's aids. Laws of Gifts to the Poor, Maimonides, chapter 10, verse 7. Giving someone a job or making him your partner would not normally be considered charity at all. It costs you nothing. But this further serves to show that tzedakah does not mean charity. It means giving people the means to have a dignified life. And within the Jewish value system, any form of employment is more dignified than dependence. We have this ruling of Maimonides in the 12th century. The principle that Muhammad Yunus rediscovered in our time, and for which he was awarded the Nobel Prize, the idea of microloans enabling poor people to start small businesses, is a very powerful idea. In contradistinction to many other religious systems, Judaism refused to romanticize poverty or anesthetize its pain. Faith is not what Karl Marx called the opium of the people. The rabbis refused to see poverty as a blessed state, an affliction to be borne with acceptance and grace. Instead, the rabbis called it a kind of death, and worse than 50 plagues. They said, "Nothing is harder to bear than poverty, because he who is crushed by poverty is like one to whom all the troubles of the world cling, and upon whom all the curses of Deuteronomy have descended. If all other troubles were placed on one side and poverty on the other, poverty would outweigh them all." Maimonides went to the heart of the matter when he said, "The well-being of the soul can only be obtained after that of the body has been secured." Poverty is not a noble state. You cannot reach spiritual heights if you have no food to eat, no roof over your head, if you lack access to medical attention, or if you are beset by financial worries. I know of no saner approach to poverty, welfare, and social justice than that of Judaism. Unsurpassed in its time, it remains the benchmark of a decent society to this day. Well, there we have Rabbi Yonatan Sacks commenting on Parsha Re'eh. Now, he mentions social justice. So I want to shift gears a little bit here and read an essay by the Middle East Forum webinar. This is an essay by Marilyn Stern, is her name, and she is reviewing another work, commenting on social justice and the Muslim Brotherhood, illusion and reality. You know, any good thing can be abused, and it can become a bad thing. Many people are of the opinion that any hyphenated kind of justice is not justice at all, because the scales of justice are balanced. Justice is neutral. It does not pick favorites. It does not choose sides. In fact, in the American system of jurisprudence, we consider justice to be a woman with a blindfold over her eyes. She can't see the people who are before her. Well, let me read this essay to you, see what you think about the concept of social justice, at least those words and how they come to be used. Craig Considine, a sociologist and author of books focusing on Islam and the West, spoke to the Middle East Forum recently. His latest book, Beyond Dialogue, Building Bonds with Christians and Muslims, is scheduled to be released in January 2025. And this summarizes the podcast. Considine is a practicing Catholic, has worked for the past decade and a half to bridge the perceived gap between these entities, the West and Islam, through the prism of Christian and Muslim relations. His passion for civil rights led him to defend Islamist organizations and believe the network of Muslim Brotherhood affiliates' claims advocating for social justice. Through a series of events, however, Considine realized he had been duped by these affiliates who subliminally use left-leaning liberal talking points as a ruse for advancing a dangerous political agenda. In 2003 and 4, Akbar Ahmed, former Pakistani High Commissioner to the UK, introduced Considine to interfaith dialogue at the American University in Washington, D.C. As Considine's career progressed, he intensified his advocacy. During the 2016 U.S. election campaign, he focused on combating what he called Islamophobia, and was drawn to the Council on American-Islamic Relations, otherwise known as CAIR, C-A-I-R, a Muslim Brotherhood affiliate that touted itself as a civil rights organization. He said, "I didn't know that there was a lot of political baggage behind it, so that's how it started." In much the same way they claim to legitimately represent Western Muslims by propagating ideals of social justice, Islamists also exploit interfaith bodies as part of a strategy to soften the playing field of diversity. One of the switches that went off in my head was when Islamists started trying to convert me. It dawned on Considine that the Muslim Brotherhood Network's interfaith facade was a sly political strategic maneuver. In 2018, Considine traveled to the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, as part of the Forum for Promoting Peace in Muslim Societies under Sheikh bin Bayah. The normalization process between the UAE and Israel had a massive, massive impact when he really listened for the first time to Jewish and Muslim elders committed to a vision of the Middle East that was about peace. A fierce backlash from Muslim Brotherhood affiliates and their allies followed his involvement in the UAE and the Abraham Accords, exposing the deeper anti-Israel, anti-Semitic ideology within the movement. Considine's 2020 book, The Humanity of Muhammad, A Christian View, garnered much attention in political spheres. Islamists didn't like the fact that I was bridging the gap between Islam and the West, he said, and turned on him. In 2021, his social media was hacked, which he attributed to his work with the Hizmet and Gulen movements. The latter is the arch nemesis of Erdogan and Turkey, Muslim Brotherhood promoters. Despite his disillusionment with the Muslim Brotherhood organizations that had previously supported him, Considine continued with the Hizmet and Gulen groups because he believed, quote, "their values aligned with my values as a Christian, but also my values as an American," or so he thought. Considine was not surprised when he received pushback from Jamaat-e-Islami, a Pakistani group that's part of the Muslim Brotherhood Network. However, he had a rude awakening after October 7. The Ahmadiyya Muslim community, with whom Considine had engaged in interfaith advocacy since 2015, almost 10 years, reacted by adopting the Islamist position. Quote, "It literally shocked me and I was hurt, and the connection with them was dropped off." The Hizmet and Gulen groups haven't been saying much of anything, which is de facto nothing. These Muslim groups had claimed to stand by these similar principles, that is, advocating interfaith relations, supporting American values of freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of conscience, the right to own property, the right to vote, and the right to assembly. October 7 revealed that it's bigger than the Islamists and the Brotherhood, too. Considine believes that there are so many organizations and sections of the wider Muslim American community that are buying into the ideology and they don't even know it. Anti-American sentiment is being taught by experts teaching the youth to hate their country. That's suicidal. That's like civilizational suicide. That's national suicide, said Considine. The Islamists and the Brotherhood have gained an even greater foothold in the U.S. academia that is so deeply embedded in far-left ideology, especially Marxism, which is obviously, I think if anyone knows, what the Islamist agenda and the Brotherhood are all about. He was transformed after seeing how Islamists exploit Marxists and their sympathizers' ideology of oppressor versus the oppressed to advance their Islamist agenda. Quote, "I'm calling out a movement and an ideology that anyone with a sane mind would understand is not good for this country," It's not good for this country because it's fundamentally opposing basic values that were entrenched in the 18th century. Considine finds that challenging left-wing talking points inevitably elicits accusations of being a racist. Anti-American sentiment is being taught by experts teaching the youth to hate their country. That's suicidal. It's like civilizational suicide, national suicide. Post-October 7 investigations into the billions of foreign money that pour into the U.S. universities from countries such as China and Qatar play a large role in fomenting this anti-American sentiment. But it's more of a structural, fundamental, deeply ingrained issue within Western academia that we've gone too far left. I think it starts with the upper echelons of these institutions getting proper leadership and making sure that hiring practices don't contribute to echo chambers in safe spaces. We need to get back to getting critical thinking into the classrooms and into academia. Islamists are prominent in the U.S. because the Brotherhood has successfully politicized everything by spreading its propaganda through mosques, Islamic centers, and such organizations as CARE, Students for Justice in Palestine, the Islamic Society of North America, and other Brotherhood affiliates. The left-wing rhetoric pushed by these organizations is replete with such buzz phrases as decolonization, critical race theory, social justice, things that resonate with a lot of the country's youth. Considine emphasizes individualism, encouraging his students to think critically as a way to counter the indoctrination in academia, which is really the antithesis, the opposite, of what the American experiment is really all about. A lot of it does start with education, but a lot of it starts with our political leaders. Politically, the Brotherhood is deeply ingrained into the Democrat Party. Republicans are unambiguous in pronouncing that the Islamist movement is not good for America. But the political inroads that the Brotherhood has made within the Democratic Party are massive, absolutely massive, and it's happening at the very, very top. Internationally, the Brotherhood is influential in Qatar, where support for Brotherhood entities in the U.S. and its Al Jazeera broadcast network is controlling the narrative. Brotherhood influence is also seen in Bangladesh, Turkey, and Hamas. Who would have thought? Considine emphasizes individualism, encouraging his students to think critically as a way to counter the indoctrination in academia, which is really about the antithesis, the opposite of what the American experiment is really about. He advises his students to make sure to read across the aisle. Read everything, not just Fox or CNN. Read both and do your homework, and then you can make a sound decision. He is concerned because a lot of this identity politics stuff is forcing young people and everyone really into tribes, into communitarianism. Considine's advice for the public at large is to be skeptical, understand that groups, entities have political objectives, and to think about the potential political implications of their allyship, their social justice efforts. It was mentioned in the description of this event, all is not what it seems, and that is true. Well, comments transcribed, you might say, by Marilyn Stern, who's the communications coordinator at the Middle East Forum. The reason I included this article is because we take a concept, we call it social justice. The Torah, in its way, talks about social justice, about doing things for the poor that are commanded to us as tzedakah. The word tzedakah is descended from the word tzedek, meaning justice. And they take things like that, social justice, which has a righteous meaning, and use it as a way of exploiting emotionalism that's attached to it for purposes that are profoundly un-American, profoundly anti-Semitic, profoundly contrary to America's, American Jews, Americans in general, best interests. Okay, that was Craig Considine on social justice and the Muslim Brotherhood, illusion and reality. Well, let's move along here. I started an essay last week that was by Caroline Glick, and she's talking about the long-term consequences of the United States intelligence leaks. And what she's talking about is really quite interesting. Is these allegations really against the administration that methods, individuals, operatives, and so on are leaked by the administration to Iran. These are methods and personnel, techniques, and so on that Israel is using and being leaked to Iran as a way to stop Israel from preventing Iran from getting nuclear weapons. Well, now the story is out a little bit, and America's not particularly happy about it, not happy about it at all. So let me just read a little summation here. In March 29 of 2012, Foreign Policy magazine reported that Azerbaijan had agreed to permit Israel to launch a strike against Iran's nuclear installations from its air bases. The same day, Bloomberg reported on a congressional report that claimed it was futile to attack Iran's nuclear installations because they were so dispersed, it's unclear what the ultimate effect of a strike would be. Foreign Policy Report magazine, the journal Foreign Policy, quoted a U.S. intelligence officer as saying, "We're watching what Iran does closely, but we're now watching what Israel is doing in Azerbaijan, and we're not happy with it." Well, let me pick it up from there. Israel's veteran military affairs commentator Ron Ben Yishai, in a column in Ynet, expressed outrage at the United States leaks. Accusing Obama of betraying Israel, Ben Yishai fumed, "This surgical strike of leaks is undertaken via reports in the American and British media, but the campaign's aims are fully operational. To make it more difficult for Israeli decision makers to order the IDF to carry out a strike, and what's worse, to erode the IDF's capacity to launch such a strike with minimal casualties." The leaks weren't only geared towards preventing an airstrike or commando raid on Iran's installations. They were directed as well against Israel's efforts to undermine the Iranian nuclear program through cyber warfare and other forms of sabotage. On June 1, 2012, the administration leaked the Stuxnet cyber warfare program to the New York Times. Stuxnet was a top-secret cyber worm developed jointly by the U.S. and Israel. Beginning in 2010, it was used to sabotage Iran's main centrifuge production site at Natanz. The Times reported that in 2012, Obama was outraged because Israel had modified the cyber worm and allegedly sought to expand the use of this cyber weapon to other Iranian installations, including economic infrastructure. The Times story quoted one of Obama's briefers telling the then president, "We think there was a modification done by the Israelis." After Obama questioned the officials, then Vice President Biden expressed outrage. Biden fumed, "It's got to be the Israelis. They went too far." The Stuxnet leak was not a one-off. 2 weeks later, the administration leaked details of another joint U.S.-Israel cyber tool called FLAME. Leaked that to the Washington Post. flame was reportedly developed for spying on Iran's nuclear program. The Post reported that the United States and Israel jointly developed a sophisticated computer virus named Flame that collected intelligence in preparation for cyber sabotage aimed at slowing Iran's ability to develop a nuclear weapon. Then there was Syria. More or less at the outset of the civil war in 2012, Israel began carrying out operations in Syria to block Iran's efforts to transfer advanced weapons, including guided missiles, to Hezbollah terror forces in Lebanon. Israel made it a point never to acknowledge its operations so as to minimize pressure on Syrian President Bashar Assad to retaliate. Beginning in 2012, as the Obama administration opened covert nuclear talks with Iran, Washington began leaking information about the Israeli strikes to the media to undermine them and deter Israel from intensifying its operations. For instance, on July 5th of 2013, the administration told the New York Times that Israel was behind a strike on a shipment of P-800 Yakont surface-to-sea missile systems in Latakia. In a long analysis of Obama's Iran strategy published in 2015, former Bush National Security Council Director Michael Doran argued that Obama chose to shield Assad from efforts to overthrow him to ingratiate himself with the Iranian regime, which he claimed rightly viewed the Assad regime as an Iranian equity. Israel's relations with the United States reached new lows in 2013 to 2015 as U.S. nuclear talks with Iran went into high gear. The talks and the agreements they produced served to legitimize Iran's nuclear weapons program and ultimately provided Iran with a windfall of cash and a glide path to a nuclear arsenal by 2025. In other words, the nuclear talks and the deals they produced constituted a strategic betrayal of Israel by the Obama administration. In October of 2022, The Wall Street Journal reported that in 2012, while keeping Israel in the dark about his nuclear talks with Tehran, Obama had U.S. spy agencies conduct aggressive espionage against Israel's military bases and eavesdropped on secret communications by Israeli leaders to prevent Netanyahu from ordering a military assault on the Fordo installation in Iran. Currently, the Biden administration is deploying a second naval carrier group to the region amid growing fears in Washington that Israel may strike Iran's nuclear installations ahead of or in the aftermath of an Iranian strike on Israel. In a similar fashion, Obama ordered a second U.S. aircraft carrier to the region in 2012 amid fears of an impending Israeli strike on Fordo. In 2013, National Security Agency defector Edward Snowden revealed that the U.S. was eavesdropping on foreign allied leaders, including German Chancellor Angela Merkel, French President François Hollande, and, of course, Netanyahu. Chastened, Obama pledged to end the practice. But insofar as Israel was concerned, far from ending the espionage, he stepped it up. In a stunning expose in December of 2015, months after the nuclear deal was approved in Congress, the Wall Street Journal revealed the extent of NSA spying on Israel. In its zeal to uncover Israel's moves to undermine the nuclear deal, Obama had negotiated with Iran. Obama's National Security Agency intercepted communications between Israeli officials and American Jewish leaders, as well as members of Congress, and transferred the information to the White House. This aggressive spying was illegal because it effectively involved spying on American citizens and lawmakers. The unprecedented move showed that the Obama administration viewed Israel's determination to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons as a major threat to its primary foreign policy goal. Realigning the U.S. towards Iran and away from Israel and the Sunni Arab states by engaging in nuclear appeasement of Tehran. During the Trump presidency, intelligence cooperation between Israel and the U.S. reached unprecedented levels of openness and intimacy. But due to his experience with the Obama-Biden administration, when Biden entered office, Netanyahu reportedly ordered Israel's spy agencies to curtail intelligence sharing with their U.S. counterparts. This policy was abrogated during the Bennett-Lapid government's 17-month tenure. Acting at the urging of the Biden administration and upon entering office in May of 2021, Bennett reinstated the intelligence sharing, and as the U.S.'s leak of Israel's role in Khodei's assassination in May of 2022 made clear, the Biden administration returned the favor by reinstating Obama's practice of leaking Israeli operations believed to endanger its efforts to appease Iran. In all likelihood, the Al Jarida report was indeed false. The implications of the report that the U.S. would facilitate the roundup and all but certain torture and murder of Mossad agents by the regime in Iran in the middle of a major war are simply too extreme to countenance. The rupture such a hostile move would cause to U.S.-Israel intelligence ties would be too severe for even a hostile administration like Biden's to accept. Even worse, from an American perspective, such a step would undermine the credibility and trustworthiness of American intelligence agencies in the eyes of partners and agents worldwide. At the same time, both the Obama-Biden and the Biden-Harris administration's records of bad faith towards Israel on issues related to Jerusalem's efforts to block Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons make it difficult at first blush to dismiss reports like Al Jarida's as simply disinformation. This is really a stunning essay of betrayal by what is supposedly Israel's closest ally, the United States, or America's closest ally, which is Israel. This essay, The Long-Term Consequences of U.S. Intelligence Leaks, by Caroline Glick. Well, see how this plays out. Doesn't sound like it'll be anything good. Well, let's move on. Here's an essay, kind of remarkable. This is an essay by Philologos. Now, Philologos is a Jewish language columnist, and he writes about words, as the title, as his name, Philologos, suggests, lover of words. And I took this essay from Mosaic magazine. Here's what he says. He starts by saying, "No, James Carville, Israelis are not whiter than Palestinians." The Democrat Party strategist James Carville recently attributed the Republican Party's relatively warmer view of Israel to deeply held racism. So apparently Republicans are racists, and that's why they like Israel. And that's rather stunning in itself. "It's really about the racism that drives the thing," Carville said. "The reason I suspect that most of these people describe themselves as pro-Israel is because the Jews in Israel are whiter than the Palestinians." Okay. None of this makes any sense, as Philologos explains, but to understand the role of the U.S.-Israel relationship in American politics, you have to become an adept student of the absurd. So, maybe Philologos can help. Here's what he says. No, James Carville, Israelis are not whiter than Palestinians. Americans, like the veteran Democrat strategist Carville, should not project their problems onto peoples who already have enough of their own. It was, to put it mildly, foolish of the veteran Democrat Party strategist Carville to say the other day, when asked about the pro-Israel position of the great majority of Republican voters, he said, quote, "It's really about the racism that drives the thing. The reason I suspect that most of these people describe themselves as pro-Israel is because the Jews in Israel are whiter than the Palestinians." As was pointed out in the wake of Carville's remarks, Israelis are not demonstrably whiter than Palestinians. Nor, since both groups vary greatly in skin color, would it be feasible to come up with a metric that might enable a comparison to be made. There are light-skinned, darker-skinned, and dark-skinned Palestinian Arabs, light-skinned, darker-skinned, and dark-skinned Israeli Jews. And while Israelis and Palestinians can usually tell at a glance which of the two groups one of them belongs to, they do not do so on the basis of skin color. What they instinctively look for are other indicators, such as body language, facial expressions, hairstyle, clothing, and head garb, and sometimes they guess wrong. It is commonplace to observe that, when applied to skin color, white and black are as much sociological as physical categories. Many so-called whites are far from white. Many blacks are not black at all. Nor does it necessarily have to do with ancestry. As we all know, Barack Obama's mother was white, and Kamala Harris's was a native of India. If both Obama and Harris are considered and consider themselves black, this is because they identify with the African-American community, and because this seems natural to most Americans. As a Columbia University linguist and New York Times language columnist John McWhorter noted in a recent column, imagine how strange it would be if someone called Obama white. Imagine how strange it would be if he called himself white. My maternal grandfather was light enough that he could easily have passed for white. My mother was quite light-skinned, also. Yet, I have never considered myself anything but black, nor did my grandfather or my mother. To look at photos of the three of us and see three black people makes perfect sense to me because I've never known anything else. True, many younger Americans with histories like Obama's or Harris's prefer to call themselves biracial, a relatively recent usage that was not an option in the past. My 1955 Oxford Universal Dictionary, for example, reprinted with corrections and revised addenda from an original 1933 edition, does not even list biracial as a word. The growing popularity of the word biracial reflects profound changes in attitude towards race and racial backgrounds in the United States, since traditionally Americans of mixed ancestry have been expected to identify with the racial affiliation of either one set of their ancestors or the other. Moreover, racist attitudes dictated that even in cases of white appearances, such as that of John McWhorter's grandfather, a single known black forebear was enough to classify the person in question as black, or Negro, or colored, at a time when these words were still admissible. Long before biracial, of course, English had terms to describe persons of mixed racial descent. These were words like mulatto, which designated the offspring of one black and one white parent, quadroon and octoroon for those having one black grandparent or great-grandparent, and half-caste or half-breed for those descended from unions between white Americans or Europeans and non-originally African populations such as Native Americans and Asians. All these words, however, had a pejorative or semi-pejorative tone, and individuals almost never used them to refer to themselves. For one thing, there were no mulatto, octoroon, or quadroon communities in America to associate oneself with. For another, as racist a country as America was, mulatto indicated an even lower status than black, since, there being very few interracial marriages, which were outrightly illegal in many American states, mixed racial descent almost always meant one or another degree of illegitimacy. It was often better to be considered black, even if one's skin color was brown, tan, or nearly white, than mulatto, which had a whiff of scandalousness that black did not. And Israel? Contemporary Israeli Hebrew has nothing like any of these words. Israelis speak of Ashkenazim, Sephardim, Mizrahim, of Rusim, of Temanim, of Gruzinim, Ethiopim, and other nationalities in their midst, by which they often mean native-born Israelis whose parents or grandparents came from Russia, Yemen, Georgia, Ethiopia, or elsewhere. But they do not use words designating skin color, nor do they have terms for the offspring of intermarried couples, such as the child of a Russian father and an Ethiopian mother. There admittedly was a period, or more accurately two of them, in which the words shorim, or blacks, was used derogatorily by some Israelis for groups of new immigrants, the first in the 1950s when it was applied to Jews arriving in Israel from Arab countries, and the second in the 1990s to Jews coming from Ethiopia. In both these cases, however, public disapproval of such language banished it from everyday speech fairly quickly. Now, that word, the Hebrew word for blacks, comes from the German word schwarz, meaning black, so it would be schwarzerim. In general, it can be said of Israelis that while they are as capable of prejudice as anyone else, their prejudices are not racial. They notice skin, eye, and hair color, of course. Who doesn't notice that? And they use them to make distinctions. This blonde, blue-eyed person is an Ashkenazi. This person, swarthy complexion person, is a Mizrahi. This tan-skinned person is a Temani. This brown person is a Ethiopi. But these distinctions do not confer a sense of otherness. As an American-born Israeli acquaintance once said to me, when I see a black person in America, I see a black person. When I see a black person in Israel, I see a Jew. Towards whom are many Israeli Jews' prejudices? The answer is obvious, towards Arabs, and specifically towards Palestinian Arabs. But here, too, it is important to emphasize there is nothing racial about this. The prejudice that the light-skinned Israeli Jew feels towards the dark-skinned Palestinian Arab is no different from the prejudice that the dark-skinned Israeli Jew feels towards the light-skinned Palestinian Arab. In both cases, there are the same feelings of superiority, disdain, fear, and distrust. Feelings, it needs to be said, that are very much the same as those that most Palestinian Arabs have for Israeli Jews. You can call such prejudice nationalist or culturalist or religionist, but it is not racist. It is the prejudice that conflicted groups and peoples have felt towards each other throughout history, whether they have been Greeks and Turks, Chinese and Japanese, Apaches and Comanches, and it tends to end or dissipate only when, after decades or sometimes centuries, the conflict itself ends. It is rarely the case that changed attitudes lead to changed politics. More often, changed politics leads to changed attitudes. This is what happened in the United States as a result of the civil rights movement in the 1960s, and it is what will happen in the Middle East when a Palestinian-Israeli peace is achieved. Americans like James Carville should not project their problems onto peoples who already have enough of their own. Well, that was a lucid essay, and I hope for you, dear listener, that it clears up somewhat the nature of prejudice and of racism and this instinct of Democrats, at least, and perhaps many more, to view everything through the lens of race. It simply is not true. Well, that was Philologos commenting on, no, James Carville, Israelis are not whiter than Palestinians. Well, let's move along here. This is an essay, brief essay, about a South African chief rabbi who slams the Pope and the Archbishop of Canterbury's rejection of biblical values. Interesting. Archbishop Justin Welby should know Jerusalem was the capital of Israel before anyone ever heard of Britain, according to Rabbi Warren Goldstein. The head of the Catholic Church and the leader of the Church of England are effectively rejecting the Bible by supporting policies that negate the connection of the Jewish people to the Holy Land, the chief rabbi of South Africa said recently. The blunt theological critique comes after the Archbishop of Canterbury endorsed a ruling by the International Court of Justice last month that Israel's presence in occupied Palestinian territories is unlawful, and as the pontiff has sought to thread the needle and maintain neutrality during Israel's war against Islamist terrorists in Gaza. At a time when Europe's future hangs in the balance, its two most senior Christian leaders, the head of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, and the head of the Church of England, Archbishop Welby, have abandoned their most sacred duty to protect and defend the values of the Bible, South African Rabbi, Chief Rabbi Warren Goldstein wrote in a post on X. Does the Archbishop read the Bible? The world is locked in a civilizational battle of values, threatened by terrorism and jihad, the rabbi said, and now is the time for religious leaders to come to the defense of society, to speak up for Western values and freedom. Instead, Pope Francis and the Anglican Archbishop are silent, indifferent to the murder of Christians in Africa and the threat of terrorism throughout Europe, and outright hostile to Israel's attempts to battle these jihadi forces led by Iran. The Jewish leader said the head of the Church of England's remarks put him in direct opposition to the Bible. Does the Archbishop believe the accounts of the Bible are mere myths? Goldstein ponders in a 15-minute video address attached to his X post. How can anyone who believes in the Bible say that Israel is an illegal occupier of the Temple Mount? After the UN court ruling, Welby said that ending Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory is a legal and moral necessity. Goldstein continued, if the Archbishop reads his Bible, he should know that Jerusalem existed before London and was the capital of Israel before anyone heard of Britain. Imploring his fellow religious leaders to go back to the Bible, the South African rabbi said that denying Israel's biblical claims to the land of Israel was a threat to both the UK, United Kingdom, and Europe at a time of rising Islamic extremism. Jihadist ideology seeks to destroy Israel and is a clear and present danger to the future of Europe and its value system, Goldstein said. If Israel is abandoned to jihadi forces, Europe is next. Well, it seems plainly obvious to people that understand Islam and the threat that the jihadis pose to Western civilization, but not so clear, apparently, to the Pope and to the Archbishop of Canterbury. Appeasers, both. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I see that we are just about out of time. So I would like to thank you for joining me today for Jewish Popery, a program of readings of interest to the Jewish community. And I'd like to remind you, my name is Michael Wolin. And I also would like to wish all of you a good Shabbos, Shabbat Shalom, and Shavua Tov. Have a good week.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.